Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel's
beating it! Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
There we go. That laughter. It's the way we love to introduce the show. Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim and Russ Cortinel. We live to breathe another week. Rusty, it's The Suspendables that you're listening to. And everyone's come to love and know you, Russ, for how much booze you can drink.
All right.
We think it's fabulous. We still haven't heard from White Claw. Okay. And you, we get a lot of funny lines from people about you and White Claw and red wine and all that jazz. And still the funniest one is, if Russ, you wanted to give a massive boost to the economy in the US, you should return your empties. So let's, anyway, great week. We got a bunch of stuff we're going to talk about.
It is Hangover Monday.
It is Hangover Monday for sure. So from time to time, you know, we have guests on, and if we don't, from all the people that Russ knows, we bring up their names for sure. And I've been in the sort of broadcast game for a long time, and I've always gone by the philosophy of we love to talk about celebrities for sure. And it's not always going to be good things. So I've always said, well, just throw the person's name out there anyway, say whatever the fuck you want, and don't worry because they never listen to the show. So last week, Rusty brings up this name. You know, he said, by the way, your buddy Whitworth won the Man of the Year award. Eh? Did you see that for the LA Rams?
No shit, Sherlock.
Yeah. There we go. There's that heartwarming relationship that Russ and I have. So anyway, Russ drops another name. Okay, whammo, boom, throw that onto the pile. Okay, there's about 7,000 names. And he goes, blah, 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 blah. And by the way, Chris Potter, who's a friend of mine. And I'm going, Chris Potter. He goes, yeah, he's on a series called Heartland. And I said, I know that series. Okay, I know. I do. Okay, it's been around for, I don't know, 15 plus years. But I didn't know Chris by name. But I know what he looks like, and you guys will get to see him shortly. And I thought, yeah, I don't care about the guy really, though. I don't know the guy that much, right? And I went on. Okay. So what I do in my big mouth is I go, oh yeah, is that Chris Potter? Is he the really old guy on that show? Okay. And Russ goes, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. He's not the old guy. I said, oh, I think he's the old guy. And that'd be wrong. Okay, that would be Sean Johnson, right, is who's the old guy. So little did I know, I get a text about half an hour after the show dropped the other day from Chris Potter saying, hey, listen to your show. and he's like, love your show. I've got a bunch of questions for you, Jerome and Russ. Love the old guy. So Chris Potter is and Heartland is a long running show. He's Ian Fleming on that show.
Tim Fleming.
What? You're not Ian Fleming?
Did he fuck that up?
Oh, Tim. Well, how's it going? I tell you what, not my fault, Chris. Not my fault. Wikipedia.
Oh, can I speak?
Yeah, you can speak.
I can't sit here any longer without. I don't need an intro. First of all, I'm not a celebrity. I'm just an actor.
Yeah.
And here we are on Valentine's Day. I'm in a love fest with you two guys.
Sure.
Jimmy loves Russ, and Russ loves himself. And where do I fit in?
That's the
did you guys ever watch? By the way, did you guys ever watch? This is just, somebody must have asked you this before, but Jerome and Rusty, does that make me friendly?
Hey.
Because, you remember the Friendly Giants?
Are you kidding me? Look up, way up.
And where did Rusty live? In a bag.
Still right? Does. Yeah, perfect. Still does. He crawls out of the bag once a week.
So maybe let me help the audience. I play Tim Fleming. I'm the father of the girls on a show called Heartland. Okay. It's run for 15 years.
Nice.
And that's all we need to talk about, Heart.
No. We got to talk more about that.
15 years. That's unreal.
Well, I thought it was like 207 or something that I was reading today.
Yeah, that's
and, when it started. I can't, in a day and age, okay, and you're a celebrity, okay, in a day and age where there's so many freaking choices, man, to watch TV from the 7,000 different streaming services and of course, all the terrestrial networks and everything, and shows lasting, I don't know, we dropped a 0.0003% in ratings, so we're canceling your show, right? It's like, what a run. What a run, Chris, before we talk hockey and a bunch of other shit that we got to talk about. That's a hell of a deal, isn't it?
Well, it is. And you never know. And leading into this opportunity in 2007, I think I had done at that point, five other series, the one that lasted 5 years, one that lasted four, one that lasted one and two. And so 15 was unprecedented, especially in Canada. So, you know, it's a part of the business that never changes, that you don't know what you're doing next year. You can sign a lengthy contract, but that does not mean that you're going to have a job next year.
Right.
It never changes. We never know ahead of time if we're picked up. And so, you know, I suppose the feeling of success ends with cut at the end of each season. And then we wait. After wrap, will we go again? And this has gone on and now almost in perpetuity. So
what is the magic day that you find out it's picked up for next year?
Well, there are contractual deadlines, but it differs every year. And the thing that's so unprecedented about Heartland is that the industry has really changed since 2007. There was very little streaming back in 2007. And the studio model was still very popular. Netflix was just beginning. I'm not sure it had maybe just begun. So that I've seen the entire industry change and become so fragmented that there's been a scramble to figure out how to monetize it.
Right.
And, you know, through it all, and not just that, but we shoot 2/3 of the series outside in the mountains, the foothills of Calgary.
Oh, Jesus.
We weren't just dealing with a temperamental industry, but we were dealing with the weather.
Wow.
And we shot through the flood back in, was that 2013 or 10?
Yeah.
The wiped Calgary out that filled the Saddle Dome up with water up to the third or 10th row or something. We've shot through hail the size of golf balls stuck on the top of a mountain, you know, where our crew's running for cover and storms that roll in and then extreme weather. And so it's a pretty resilient bunch out there in Alberta. Very impressive. And being a guy from Ontario growing up in London, and Toronto, Canada being such a Toronto centric place to a fault, I feel. I really come to love Alberta and the people that work in the industry out there, the people that live out there.
Right. Hey, Chris, you know who you sound like right now?
No.
Jim's drug dealer talking about Jim.
What? Resilient.
Hey, you're resilient. Yeah.
I'll tell you what. It takes a man. I'll tell both of you. It takes a man to face a three gram cocaine habit a day for 25 years. Okay. That takes a man.
Hey, let me ask you guys, is the suspendables, is it hockey related or academic related?
I'll tell you something. True.
A lady from Australia came up with the name.
Yeah, she did. And then people started searching it, and there's actually the first search thing that comes up is a fetish site with people suspending themselves with hooks, you know, on the that deal, Russ, you guys get hammered and you're trying to hang yourself up with hooks.
No, we don't do that.
Tell me this, Chris, everybody, everybody growing up at one time or another, almost everybody, either is told or thinks to themselves, I should be an actor. You know, I should get into the acting game. You know, you got a million stories, Jimmy, Russ, you know, you live in LA. How did it all start for you? And was it always going to be acting, or walk us through your career a little bit? And before sure. you do that, what were the other series you were in, by the way? Cause they were long runners too there.
Yeah. Well, so I'll start with the first question, which was, I touched on, I was born in Toronto. I grew up in London, Ontario. My dad was, with London Life, but he was a football player in the early days and drafted out of Mimico High School Mimico High School to play for the Argos.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And then he coached the East York Argonauts back then when I was a toddler. When we moved to London, my dad took over the head coaching job of London Lords. My mother got into theater because she had a singing background. So That was always a big part of our family, music and sports. And my parents introduced us to both of those interests. And I played competitive sports all the way through. But I loved music and I picked up instruments and so on. So I started in theater as a boy doing amateur theater in London, Ontario, musical after musical. And in fact, I can remember being in the dressing room and probably around peewee age. And one of the kids in the dressing room said, Potter, you in a play? I said, no. And he said, yes, you are. My parents saw you in a play downtown with your brother.
Oh, no.
I said, well, he said, yeah, you're in a Potter's in a play.
Uh-oh.
At the time, I thought, yeah, you know, I'm having a lot of fun playing hockey, but this play is really fun. Like the kids I'm hanging out with.
Right.
We were doing Oliver at the time, and I was in the chorus. But that hobby turned into a dream for me, and I really focused on music. And so in my late teens, I had a rock band that was, you know, filling up the local bars in London.
Oh, cool.
And I really had a rock and roll dream for a while. So I ended up with a group of guys that traveled in a bus from Detroit, Michigan, all the way up to Hull, Quebec. We used to play the Chaudière in Hull.
Sure. I know the Shot. We used to sneak in there. Yeah, yeah.
Hated that place because he had to start at 10 and play till 3 in the morning.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Quebec drinking laws. Yeah,
we'd have to be in Sudbury the next night at the Northbury Hotel.
My hometown. My hometown,
you know the Northbury?
Yeah, I know
it the Northbury. It used to be the Holiday Inn.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Right. So we played there. That's a long drive from Hull, you know, in the winter.
Terrible drive.
Yeah. So that evolved into more work in amateur theater. And eventually I was in a play at the age of 28 and I was married to my wife, Karen, and she was into her teaching career. And she came home one day and she said, boy, I'm just loving this. She said, I really got through to this kid today. And I kind of thought, that sounds like you're doing the right thing for your interest. So I came home from this play one night. It was at the Grand Theater in London, Ontario. And I said to Karen, I had the audience in the palm of my hand tonight.
Nice.
You know, I love this. And I was working at London Life at the time.
Right.
I said, I love this. You know, honey, I think I should be a teacher. And she said, no, stupid. You should be an actor.
Sure.
What a girl, Karen.
And to be honest with you, there was no avenue. You know, I had already given up on a career in the arts. So I figured I'll work at London Life the rest of my life and I'll do this as a hobby. But I was discovered in that play by Martha Henry from Stratford and a director from Vancouver named Larry Lilo. Mm-hmm. And they offered me a full-time job in the grand stage, professional stage. And I used my holiday time from London Life to do the rehearsals and try to shorten the story. But basically, I got an offer from CBC to do my first pilot for them in 1988.
Oh, cool.
Called Coming and Going, which was about commuters on the GO train, written by Louis Del Grande, who had done a show called Seeing Things that was popular. Yes,
I remember that. Seeing Things, yeah.
Yeah. So the London Free Press did an article
front page on me, on this actor, local actor, used to sell insurance, now sells himself, makes it on the big on the grand stage. And I worked for my father, and he had 75 reps that worked under him, London right. Central, men and women. He came into my office with this front page, and it was a picture of me, my head shaved, and a gold tooth implanted, and fake tattoos on my arms and dog tags because I was doing the play Biloxi Blues by Neil Simon.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And at that point, I had to fully commit. We were into dress rehearsal. So they shaved our heads, which in 1988 was no one shaved their heads back then.
No.
It wasn't, unless you know you were making a statement. But my dad said to me, what is this? And I said, oh, I've been meaning to talk to you about that. He said, well, it says here that you used to sell insurance and now you sell yourself. And it talks about an offer you got from CBC. And he said, you can't wear two jackets. And I said, well, Dad, you know, this is a real opportunity. And he said, well, son, you got a wife and a house and a baby on the way.
Right.
And he said, what kind of offer is this? And I said, well, it's a 13-week offer, 13 shows. We do one a week in front of a live audience in Toronto. I said, you and Mom could come and see it. What do you think? He said, yeah, we'll see about that. He said, what do they pay you? And I said, $5,000. And he said, for 13 weeks work? And I said, no, that's a week. My dad said, well, you know, you could always give it a try. If it doesn't work out, you can get your dad. But I've got to be honest, I had a great father who was a giant amongst men. And I love him and I miss him. But, you know, his endorsement that day opened the door for me. And at that point, I just was going to do whatever it took for me to survive, you know, to make it in the business, right. Because it was a real gamble for me in my life, and it was asking a lot of my wife and everybody around me.
That's awesome.
By the way, the Seeps and Joe Cools, maybe the best two bars.
Played for the Seeps fastball team every summer.
Oh, you did, yeah. those are bars in London, folks. I used to go down for the Western homecoming, and never leave that bar. I never went to the football game or anything. I never made it to that hill. Apparently, the hill is that where everyone sits.
That's where my wife, Karen, and her family, her dad was a prof in phys ed and coached the Mustangs, as did my father for 13 years. But they never paid for a ticket. They'd always sit up on the hill. And I thought,
sure. Yeah, why would you?
You guys don't pay for tickets? Like, how much are the tickets? Like, we always sat in the stadium.
What's your... you'd said you got a million stories, and I love the stories from actors and the gigs that they took that they didn't want to, or you know, stories about trying to get paid and what they did do for no money. You said you got a million stories. How about auditions?
Well, a quick audition story. Hey, you know, I don't want to get too much into the acting world. I got a lot of sports stories too, but
yeah, we'll get to those.
I suppose the one big break for me in the U.S. was I had back in the late 80s and early 90s, if they picked you up on off of an audition in Canada, the networks would fly down first class to screen test against one other person for a network series.
Right.
And I had never been to L.A. They were interested in me for a role in a series called Baby Talk, which was based on the movie Look Who's Talking that starred John Travolta and Kirstie Alley. So they were going to do a TV series. It was Ed Weinberg who had just done Taxi. It was a big deal.
Right.
And when you do a screen test, you sign a contract before you even get the job, which seems backward and weird. And it's when you're a young guy and you sign the dotted line on that big number, I'm sure it's like the first time you sign a hockey contract. Like, you think, you know, the number it's hard to comprehend, whatever it is. But, you know, I went, signed the contract. The other guy showed up and we talked with each other. one of us, I was going to go on first screen test with Connie Selica on the stage of Who's the Boss and Tony Danza's set. And we were going to do the scene in front of all the brass who sit in the dark. And I went and talked to the other guy, and the guy said to me, "Well, one of us is going to get our throat cut today."
Nice.
And I thought, yeah. And I thought, well, I hope it's you, but no offense. Fair. So we did our thing. And as I say, I hadn't been to LA. They put me up at the Sportsman's Lodge. I got checked into my room and my light, you know, no cell phones back then. So yeah, my light on my phone is flashing. Pick it up, and it's my agent, Jerry Zeitman. And he said, "I'm sending over a script for Warner Brothers for Kung Fu. They're going to do the new Kung Fu." And I said, "Okay, with who?" "With David Carradine, the original guy."
Yeah, said, nice.
"Where's he been for 20 years?" And the first thing Jerry said to me is, "Don't worry, he doesn't drink anymore." And I said, yeah. "All right." I said, but wait, I came down here for this other thing. What about the other thing?" And he said, "Oh, you didn't get that." And I said, "Well, what did I do? Like, who got it?" He said, "The other guy got it." And I said, "Who was that guy? He was a nice guy." He said, "His name's George Clooney. He's been kicking around town for a few years."
No way. Oh, my God.
And George, who, you know, clearly is an exceptional man, exceptional guy, did do that job. And wow. I don't know how it went. The next day, I went in, actually, that same day, early evening. And I read for the producers of this Kung Fu remake they were going to do. And that they wanted to screen test me in the morning. So I called my wife, Karen, and I said, "I got to stay a little extra." She said, "What's going on?" I said, "Actually, I haven't got a clue what's going on. But I'm going to sign another contract, and I'm going to go in and try to get this job. And they want to test me tomorrow." So I show up at Warner Brothers, and it's a 10 a.m. test. And I show up early, about 9 in the morning. And I knew I was going to be testing with David Carradine, but I didn't know anything about him. So I had been in sales, and I don't know what gave me the foresight, but I thought, I asked my agent, I said, what's he into? And he said, "Well, he's got a ranch. He likes horses. And he likes guitars." And I thought, okay. So I still had the Toronto paper with me from the flight. So I looked at outdoor at properties for rent outside of Toronto that were horse farms and stuff. And I thought, well, this might break the ice. So I get there early. I see this guy show up and get out of a convertible. He had a driver. And he's leaning against the wall, smoking English Oval cigarettes. He chain smoked those. And I walk up and I said, "Hi, David, I'm Chris. I'm screen testing with you." And I said, "Hey, I hear you like horses. So here's the Toronto paper. It's a farms for rent. You know, we're going to be shooting this thing in Toronto." Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he said, "Don't worry about a thing." And we went in and tested again in front of all the brass. And it became clear to me that I kept thinking, is he drunk? Kind of drunk? And I could peripherally see that the other producers and so on, the brass, were thinking the same thing. And nobody was watching me. They were all watching him.
Yeah.
And the audition ended, and I went out and lied down on the floor of John Levy's office, this casting director. And I was kind of, you know, having an anxiety attack. And David came out. And he kicked me in the ribs. This wasn't the only time he punched me or kicked me. He was kind of a physical guy.
Sure.
He kind of gave me a boot in the ribs like you would to your little brother or something. And he said, "You got it." And I said,
"No way."
He said, "Are you sure?" He said, "They're in there talking about it. I told him you're the guy. You got it." He goes, "You drink?" I said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "Let's go celebrate." So I said, "It's 10:30 in the morning. Where are we going to celebrate?" So he walks me across the street. He walks me across the street to El Torito. And we go through the kitchen And it's clear that all the guys in the kitchen know David. Like, hello, David. Hello. And he walks in and we start drinking 10:30. By about 2:30, after he's told me his whole life story, and not asked one single question about my life, which you got to get used to with a guy like that.
Yeah.
He was an amazing guy. I loved him. Don't get me wrong, but I didn't have much to tell him anyway. But he said, "Do you have a car?" I said, "Well, I can get a rental." And he said, "Okay, you get a rental. We'll drive out to my place." And I thought, "Well, how am I gonna get a rental car? I'm hammered.
Pissed.
I'm
hammered." Yeah.
So he ended up calling up a buddy of his that had a car, and this guy drove us out to David's. I met his wife, who was also hammered, and we walked into the house. There was vodka bottles everywhere, and he grabbed a couple of beers, and he said, "Come on, follow me." So we followed him into the living room, and he started taking all his clothes off down to his Speedo that he had on, and he was completely covered in tattoos.
That's so funny.
And I just thought,
thank God you already had the part.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Anyway, this story goes on, and it ends up with me back at the Sportsman's Lodge, phoning my wife, hammered, and saying, I think I've got this, and I confirmed it with my agent. And that was my first foray into L.A. and screen testing and jobs.
Cool, man.
Grasshopper, if you could snatch the bottle of vodka from my hand.
Yeah. God, I loved him. I loved Kung Fu.
Well, David was an enigma, and I've worked with many people like that in he's one of a kind, but a lot of artists that are really gifted and genius with their talents are not always the most functional people outside of it. Yeah. So they're my kind of people.
Yeah.
It's been a wonderful ride, but yes, I did that series, and then when that ended, I went down and starred in Silk Stockings for the USA Network.
Oh, sure.
4 years. Yeah. That's where San Diego came into play, because we raised our kids here and so on. And but it's not unlike, I suppose, playing professional sports. It's you travel, your wife gets good at moving kids and enrolling people in schools, and really, it's real teamwork. And I got to have a great partner to succeed in it.
Yeah, good for you, man. And not a bunch of heavy lifting, right? It's not,
it's a lot of years in a trailer. Sure. This whole movement with people that are doing luxury vans and traveling, and I that is so unappealing to me when you spend 33 years in Winnebago. The last thing I want to do is get in a motorhome and go somewhere. No freaking way.
You said when we talked to you, texted back and forth early in the week, you said, "I got questions, man. I got questions for you guys." And I said, "No, fuck. No, I don't want questions." But here you are. Here you are. You're a big sports fan. You listen to the show. And you get a chance here. If you'd like to ask some questions, we'll try our level best.
Well, I have the luxury of already knowing Russ. So, and by the way, we reconnected after about 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years.
And our connection came through the celebrity all-star hockey team.
Right.
Yeah.
Which I suppose I was a celebrity and Russ would be the all-star. So, but we raised a lot of money over the years through four different causes, but it was also about awareness for the NHL. One thing that's interesting is that team would attract, it took actors as well as hockey players to attract massive crowds at these places we would play. Actors were a draw. People wanted to see actors play hockey with alumni, with ex-pros.
Sure.
In Canada, no one wants to see an actor play hockey. Hockey's a religion in Canada. It's like, why does the actor get to be out there with my Leafs? So
true.
It was a dream opportunity for me to be able to play in all those games with all those different guys. Dave Coulier, who was a comedian.
I remember Dave. Yeah, sure. Full House.
He put together two games back to back when the Detroit Red Wings had won the cup. I think it was 2 years in a row they won with the Russians and the tragedy that happened with the Russian limousine accident. And
right.
All that. But there I was participating in a game, and I'm on the ice in front of 16,000 people at Joe Louis Arena with Steve Yzerman at center ice and Kirk Gibson, the baseball player, on left wing.
That's funny, man. That's funny.
And I pick up the puck and I'm skating down the ice, and I see Gibson breaking down the left wing, and I see that he's open. And but there's Steve Yzerman. So I feed the puck off to Steve. We get back to the bench, and Kirk Gibson says, what the fuck? Didn't you see me? I was wide open. And I thought, yeah, but Steve Yzerman was at center ice. You're Kirk Gibson. But that, you know, and that also in that game, I remember Brendan Shanahan, I ended up on right wing with him, and he said to me, we're playing with Igor. He goes, just get open.
Holy man.
Yeah.
Sure enough, Igor Larionov picked the puck up. So I skated straight to the net, and there the puck was on my stick. And I said, you know, I scored. And, you know, it was such a thrill for me to be a part of that. I always felt like I'm not worthy because it was like a fantasy hockey camp, but met a lot of great guys. And Russ is one of them. So
sure. Cool. Super cool.
The questions I have, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Actually more about you.
Oh, here we go.
Well, you're only human. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, your intro to the show reminds me of sort of 1980s Q107 Derringer rock guitar. That's
sure, I know Derringer.
That's a Gibson Les Paul with a crank Marshall, possibly played by Phil X, maybe.
Wow.
Or Gino Scarpelli from Gatto. But my question was that your background in Edmonton? Were you the Derringer type?
No, I wasn't. Hardly. So I got a full-time morning show job in Ottawa. I went to high school and university in Ottawa. As everyone knows, my dad was a politician, Speaker of the House. And so we lived in Ottawa for high school and university. And I was doing comedy, and I did a gig they were honoring Brian Kilray, Rusty, right? The great junior coach, Killer. And I emceed the gig, and then a guy from radio station asked me to jump on and do a show for their afternoon drive show. And that's how it started. And that's where I ended up having the 13-year run. Or I paid the guy, one of the two. But it was actually a friend of mine who was a huge client, huge advertiser with the radio station. He's the guy who said, get my buddy on. And I was lucky. So I don't know if you were asking me a serious question or whether I was supposed to make a joke.
No, I was, because I also wondered how, because you clearly spent some quality years with the Oilers in their heyday. And I wondered how that all happened. Was it through your radio personality work, or was it?
Yeah, well, so I came out in 85 with Molson. That's how I moved from Ottawa to Edmonton, got a gig, and I was the rep for the Oilers. And so that's
okay.
Yeah. And it was such a lucky day for them when I walked into the dressing room that I was there.
And you stay there. It's been your home ever since.
It has been. And with a quick trip back to Ottawa for a couple of years, but no one believes me when I say this, but the way I got to know Gretz was I called him a stalker to his face because I saw him in the morning down at the rink. And then I gave him an award, or I saw him at a press conference in the afternoon because Molson was so involved. And then that night, prior to the game, I presented him the what they call the Molson Cup for the guy who wins the most stars. And of course he won it all the time. And then I was at the bar, you know, trying to cut one from the herd. Okay. You know what I mean, Chris? Okay. There's a farming term, rodeo term. And he was there with Mess and a bunch of guys. And I waved him over and I said, what are you, a stalker? You some sort of stalker? You can't leave me alone. He laughed his bag off. And then we played golf the next day. So that's how that happened. Thanks for asking, Chris. I appreciate that.
Did you play some hockey growing up, at minor hockey or anything like that? Or?
Yes, I was a fantastic hockey player. Speaking of Gretz, he said Jerome's the only guy who doesn't know anything about hockey, and he grew up in fucking Canada in hockey hotbeds.
He hung out with hockey players to get the leftovers.
I did. No, I was a good hockey player. I played till midget, but all the rest of my brothers and sisters were ski racers. And back in those days, as you know, growing up, you were at the mercy of what your parents wanted you to do, which was fine. And I just remember my old man saying, I'm not driving all over the freaking city. You're coming in the same station wagon to ski racing. So that was the end of my hockey career. But yeah,
it was sort of one or the other for kids back then. Once you're in the pipeline with minor hockey, it's pretty hard to leave it up until it left you.
It did.
Well, and back then too, you could play multiple sports. They didn't overlap, except where I lived in Victoria, it was soccer and hockey. And then baseball started after. So you were able to play multiple sports, but now you pretty much got to pick one.
It's funny you mentioned that, Russ, because some of my memories playing, I always played competitive sports in minor hockey. But when I think back to minor baseball, I remember hating to play against a certain team because Doug Crossman was their pitcher, and playing against Byron when Rob Ramage was pitching and he was 6'1" at the age of 14 years old. I grew up that way too, playing against guys that were multi-sport athletes, and I was one of them. But as we touched on it one day when we were together, Russ, about the odds of a young minor hockey league player ever being paid to play hockey. And in the speak out program that every parent has to take if they want to get involved in minor hockey, it's a one night program that creates awareness, you know.
Make sure they're not insane. That's what that's for.
Yeah, pretty much. But they give one of the first things, they give you a statistic. It's like, I don't know what it, I can't remember. It was just huge. It was like 1 in 4,000 kids of any age group is going to end up getting paid to play hockey, move on.
Right.
And of course, every parent in that room is thinking, well, it's my kid.
Feel sorry for all you other parents. You're wasting your time.
Yeah. Too bad for everyone else. You're going to play second.
The truth is that that's really the way it pans out. So
did you go, I don't know if you might be too young, Rusty. And I don't know how old you are, Chris. I'm probably the oldest guy here at 60. Do you remember we used to get dressed at home? They had skidoo boots, they were called back then, and you had your sticks, you know, your skates went over the blade of your stick. You threw it over your, you know, you look like a hobo, right? You threw it walking down the street. And we loved playing. And yet our coach was a buddy of mine, father, his father. And none of us were showing up for practice, you know, during the week. He'd have a couple of half hour practices that you'd have to go down on a Wednesday or Thursday night. And nobody came, but everyone showed up for games. Yeah. And he shut the door to the shack. It was it had a wood burning stove. Fuck, I sound like I should be on the Waltons, man. Jesus Christ. This is how old I am. And he shut the door and he said, okay. And he wagged his finger at everyone. He said, no one came to practice this week, you know? And some of you, we have them Saturday mornings when there's not game, and no one showed up last Saturday for the practice. And he says, you got to decide, okay? You little pricks, okay? You got to decide. Do you want to stay home and watch cartoons on Saturday, or do you want to come and play hockey? And if you want to watch cartoons, you can leave right now. Six kids got up and fucked off. And they walked out the door, you know. The good old days of outdoor hockey, man. Listen, we got to, before anyone goes, we got to talk about the Super Bowl. We'll get your comments, Chris, on this. Rusty, it was this weekend, your buddy, I said at the top of the show, your buddy Whitworth won Man of the Year.
Yes.
He looked good out there. The LA Rams win it in a fantastic game. It was looking like Cincy was going to win the thing the whole way. They sort of took control of the thing. So it was excellent. They win. And I covered. Okay.
Ooh, I didn't.
Yeah, I covered. The line was 3.5. The halftime show. I don't know if you saw it, Chris, or not. It's hard to believe that rappers and hip hop artists who I like would now be called oldies. Okay. You know, it was 50 Cent and Snoop Dogg.
Dr. Dre.
Yeah, Dr. Dre, Eminem, Mary J. Blige. I thought it was just fantastic, man. I really did. I was typical of me in an afternoon. I'm by myself in my house on my couch. And I was up jumping around, man. I thought it was really, really good. What'd you think, Rusty, of the game and then the halftime show?
Well, the game was nerve-wracking because, you know, this is Witt's probably his last game yesterday. 40 yep. years old, never won a Super Bowl. He wins Man of the Year. So there was a lot riding on it. LA was all fired up. Every community that I went through was the Rams flags were flying. And so we were nervous. And then there was a period of time there that it just looked like they weren't going to win. There was, right. The game was just flatlined and it wasn't, right. It wasn't going their way. And then obviously our boy Cooper Kupp, just played a freaking outstanding I thought he put the team on his shoulders and won it. But,
did he ever? Yep.
I sent Witt a text and Melissa, his wife, a text after, and just, it was all lovey dovey. I mean, they're just, he was so relieved. He said to Melissa, I've wanted to win every game that I've ever played, mm-hmm. but this game I have to win.
Ooh,
I have to win this game. And he had 2 weeks every night going to bed. That's his mindset was, I've got to win this game. I've got to win. This is my last chance.
Well, he put a ribbon on it. He put a ribbon on a career that is unbelievable. Outstanding, right. That guy. And he plays blindside tackle.
Yeah.
What a fitting ending. But I can't get over Cooper Kupp. To me, he is he's kind of a combination of modern day speed, but like old time football, classic football player. Like, you know, when that guy gets the ball, he'll never get less than 5 yards. Unless he's rarely, he is so elusive, and yet he's not a big guy or speedster. You know, and every game they did this for the past 4 or 5 games, the Rams kind of keep him in the weeds and mm-hmm. you work him a bit, but then you'll see they just start to let him chip away at that. He won that game for them.
Yeah, he's awesome.
I'll tell you what was as impressive about him. So Odell Beckham goes down, right? And the guy was on fire. Okay, mm-hmm. It was a great story because Cleveland kicked him out. He said, "Get out of here." So he ends up in L.A. and he's lighting it up during the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And he's ripping his way through the first half there, and then he gets hurt. This Cooper Kupp, man, is so good. I love Chris Collinsworth and Al Michaels who do the game. And when he went down, they said, okay, well, they only got one guy to go to. And Chris Collinsworth said, they're going to have to double team him, you know, triple. They're going to have a guy on him like Stink. And if I'm LA, I'm still going to throw him the ball no matter what.
Yeah.
Like Chris said, that's what's going to happen.
When they were down at the one.
Yeah.
The goal line. I actually thought they should just hand off the ball to him. He has an elusive way about him. He's tough to get a handle on. So I thought maybe they're going to just pitch him the ball and get him. He'll make it in somehow. He'll do it.
We better talk a little hockey. Okay. We better talk a little hockey before we go. Rusty, the women are teeing it up. Boy, was this unpredictable in the women's at the Olympics. U.S. is playing Canada.
Yeah.
Rusty, first of all, and Chris, we'll get your opinion on this too. Rusty, how are teams getting into the Olympics, okay, that are losing 13-1, 15-0? We know what was the number there like when they started. Canada had 30 goals in 2 games or something.
Yeah.
And 3 against. I get it. Okay, I get it. It's all lovey-dovey, but fuck that. Enough. You're not getting into the Olympics unless you reach a certain standard. Am I wrong there, boys?
It's the Olympics. That's, you know what? These kids that are playing on these teams that are getting spanked, it's still their Olympics and their dream. And yeah, they're not up to the caliber of the two great teams of Canada and the U.S., but it's still the Olympics, still a big deal for them.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And think about the games they play amongst the other teams. I mean, they're having probably good games against those other weak teams. So there's just two great teams, and then everybody else is probably the same.
Who's going to win?
Coin toss.
Oh, get it. You're chafing your ass sitting on the fence. Get off the fucking fence, dude. Okay, this is not a fence sitting show. Let's go to Chris. Who's going
to
win?
This year, I think I'd have to go with Canada, but I got to say, over the years, that's probably been my favorite athletic event to watch at the Olympics is women's hockey. They, you know, you guys notice, it's like this with the LPGA. Women play sports differently than men. Women, you watch the PGA golfers, they're very serious. The women always seem to be having fun somehow. And it's the same with other competitive sports. They seem to have a different approach. It's not that they're less competitive. It's just they're women. They enjoy the game differently, but they play. And I think women's hockey at a professional level is just a beautiful sport. They're exceptional skaters. Same with soccer. They're exceptional athletes. There's a real grace to it. They don't get caught up in the minutiae as much.
The girls' soccer don't lay around and fake injuries. They're fucking way tougher than the men. I got two girls' soccer players.
Russ, do you ever have soccer players? Sure you do. Have you guys talked about that?
Yeah, we talked about it last week. Brooklyn's going to the Dominican tomorrow to meet her team for the U20 qualifier for the World Cup competition. Woo-hoo! So she's leaving tomorrow morning, and Dad's going to drive down to USC and pick her up with her two teammates at 4:30 in the morning.
Good for you.
Drive her to the airport. 6:30 a.m. flight. So
who's your daddy? Yep.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. To your point, Chris, and congratulations to your daughter, Russ. I don't.
Mean yeah. Thank. No. No. Thank you.
That at all. To your point about the PGA guys, right? That they're, they're playing for diapers. Okay. Or are they anymore? Okay. The dough's pretty good. This just in. To your point where they're not having enough fun, it's funny you bring this up on the Monday following the Phoenix Open or the Waste Management Open, because all you got to do is tune into that and watch the most fun that people have ever had at a golf tournament is on the 16th hole, the arena hole. There were two hole in ones, Russ, or holes in one, whatever they're called. And the place is just like party central. It's the biggest, one of the biggest parties in America they're talking about now. And a guy got a hole in one, Russ, and everybody, okay, threw their $20 beers onto the green.
Is that what I saw? The beer cans. I didn't know what that was.
The one guy in the back who got the
hole. Oh no.
A couple of hole in ones, but the one guy got the Mexican golfer, PGA golfer, forget his name.
Ortiz.
Ortiz got smoked in the back with a beer can.
Well, that would put a golfer out for a month.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, not athletes,
Jimmy, sir. Jimmy, I've got to agree with you that it is the Waste Management is an absolute shit show of a good time, but never take your 12-year-old son to it, which I did.
No. You did?
I had no idea. In fact, we were down golfing, the two of us, in Phoenix, and we were playing different courses. We were a little golf trip together. And he kept saying to me, Dad, that blimp over there, there's a PGA tournament on. And I didn't really follow the PGA tour. And
right.
I said, well, let's go. So we went. They dropped us off in the desert in a bus or picked us up. We parked in the desert. They picked us up, took us to the site. The moment we walked in, there was a woman lying on a hill, passed out with her skirt hiked up, right up. My son's
show and tell.
Gray is watching us. And on the way out, I kept saying to him, watch out there, because there was puke all over the place on the way out. But we had a wonderful day together, but I had no idea. I think if you're with the right crowd at that tournament, some of your friends, it's probably a great time. But boy, it was memorable for me as a dad.
My buddies from Calgary are in the oil business, and they brought in a lot of clients, flew me over for the week of golf and that event. Oh my God. It was an absolute shit show. We had they had rented a box, and before we got there, they gave us all green jackets. So we all rolled in with green jackets.
Oh, of course.
Oh yeah. It was great. And it was fun. It was one of those trips where you tell your wife you're going away for 2 days. And on the fourth day, she texts me and goes, where are you? And I took a picture from where I was at the 16th hole. And I said, I'm here. And she goes, but you told me you're coming home. I go, yeah, well,
Not quite.
No. Yeah. So I headed home the next day.
Did I ever tell you the story, Rusty, about the Olympics in Vancouver in 2010? And I ended up sitting with Christine Simpson, who's a iconic sports reporter.
Yeah.
So every game at the Olympics, of course, I'm following Gretz around. Okay.
Yeah.
And we got tickets to every game. And of course, it culminated in the gold medal game. And we would just go down, get our tickets. Gretz would fan them out. Here you go, Jimmy. Lucky me. And so then the gold medal game, I get a ticket and I go to my seat and I'm screaming, man. Okay. I'm like, this is, you know, it's the gold medal game, man. And I'm loving this. And Christine Simpson is sitting beside me. She had the other ticket. And I get up and I'm going, let's go, Carol. Right. And she gives me the eye roll. Okay. Gives me the eye roll. Jim, please, please, you know. Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck? Are you kidding me? You know? And I know Christine, I love her. But she went, please, Jim, calm down. Right. I'm going, oh my God, I had to sit down. And every time I raised my voice or something, you know, she'd start, please, you know, and I went, okay. I was going out between periods all the time. I was meeting Glennie Gretzky for a smoke. We'd go out and have a smoke. And then I was so pissed. I was telling Glenn, I'm like, you won't believe what's happening here. And as I'm saying that, speaking of wearing green jackets, Russ, this guy is walking through the concourse, okay, absolutely hammered with a tuba, Chris, okay? The guy brought a tuba, okay, the big tuba to the game. And I pulled him aside, you know, and I said, hey, listen, I got a really good seat. I'll trade you the seats for the next period. And he's like, where are they? And I showed him the ticket, right? And so I sent him up to sit beside Christine Simpson with his tuba for the gold medal game. So,
Jimmy, I got to weigh in here.
Yeah, yeah.
Don and Marion Simpson are
London.
Like my godparents.
No.
So my father and Don grew up in Mimico, New Toronto, as boys and have been friends ever since we moved to London. We have been inseparable since childhood with the Simpsons, with Jan, who passed away this year.
Yeah.
It's terrible. David, who was a rock star junior hockey player. Craig, and then Christine, the baby.
Yeah.
And they are family to me.
Oh, that's so cool.
Did I put my foot in my mouth again?
No, okay. You sure didn't, because Chris can roll with anything. And, and you know, they're a remarkable family. When you think about their contribution to hockey, it was something else. I never forget about Craig Simpson. We would stick him in net in road hockey because he was younger than all of us. So we always threw Craig in goal and fire the tennis balls at him. And one year in high school, his brother David won every award you could win in junior hockey.
Right.
And he was the captain of the London Knights. And it was all David all the time. And I remember saying to my father, wow, David's been drafted. He's doing well. And my dad said to me, Craig's the one to watch.
And oh, I said, wow.
Craig. I said, Craig, he's like 13 years old. He said, you watch Craig.
Yeah.
Within about a year, he was playing for the London Diamonds, the junior B team. I think he was 14 or something. And then the next thing he was at Michigan. And the next thing, he was in the NHL at the age of 18. And then a couple of years later in Edmonton.
Yeah.
Craig just was exceptional from the time he was born. And yet his brother David, you know, was getting all the accolades. It was really amazing. He had a great career, Craig.
He peaked.
Yeah, and he played with Rusty here at the same time. And I'm surprised he has a spine. And I don't mean he's spineless.
No.
Oh, the amount he got cross-checked was unbelievable. Unbelievable. Was
yeah.
Listen, what a great show.
Yeah.
You know, Rusty, and when you're telling the story about your buddy Whitworth, you know, and he said, I've got to win this game. I'm going to win this game. And of course, Russ, you could relate to that, what it's like winning a championship. Oh, no, you can't relate to that.
Yeah, fuck you.
Isn't that terrible, Chris? Isn't that terrible to give a shot?
You're not going to get me to go there with you, Jimmy, because I Russ Cardinal's a hero of mine. So, you know, he's got a lot of stories that they might not involve carrying the Stanley Cup around, but
talk
to him about what it was like to walk into Sarajevo and the Olympics and the experiences he's had. I got to stick up for him there, but now he's just a chef.
Yeah, just a chef. But I open wine and I cook.
Chris, thanks a million, man, for doing this. Congratulations on a fantastic career, man. Heartland's the show you're on. Been on for 15 years and still going strong, man. And we really appreciate it, Chris. Take it easy, brother.
Love you guys.
Thanks for being with us. Please be sure to subscribe to The Suspendables today and share the show with your friends and followers. And find out everything you need to know about the show on our brand new website, thesuspendables.com.